WBOI Presents In Session is a new series where we'll hear from teachers, educators, and experts on all sorts of topics, sharing their lessons in the WBOI studios. As part of our commitment to lifelong learning, In Session gives us an opportunity to partner with those who have something to teach us. During this episode, we'll hear from Andy Downs from Purdue Fort Wayne on the topic of political science. Thank you for listening. Welcome to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. 2019 is a municipal election year, and I know that's music to the ears of my next guest, Andy Downs, director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, we've passed the deadline to file for running for election. Noon on Friday, February 8th was the deadline. But hypothetically, if I wanted to run, say, for mayor, what would be the steps I would have to take to file as a candidate?
For the most part, we think about candidates as either being major party candidates, Republicans or Democrats. But what some people need to remember is that you could always run as a third party candidate or even as an independent. So that deadline was actually for the Republican Party and the Democratic Party because you want their nomination. And all you really do is file a couple of pieces of paper down at the election board and you're a candidate. There's no need to get a bunch of signatures, no amount of money to raise. If you had walked into the election board office and said, I want to be a candidate for mayor, they would have gotten the paper out for you and asked whether you wanted to be on the Republican or Democratic ballot. You would have told them. They would have handed the paper to you. You'd have filled it out, signed it, and that would have been it.
This is WBOI Presents In Session. Our guest instructor is Andy Downs. And this episode is Political Science, Lesson 1. So when I first asked you to come to WBOI to talk political science, the challenge we ran into was selecting a topic. There's a lot of options. And then we realized with the deadline to file for election just recently passed, now is a good time to discuss selecting candidates. Now, thankfully, public radio listeners are, I think we could say, more civically engaged than the average American. So if you're listening now, there's a good chance you've voted recently in a general election, maybe a primary before that. But I want to start with something that's maybe less familiar for people, and that's caucuses. Again, depending on where you live, you may or may not have experienced them. But what are some of the different definitions of the word? I mean, I think of the word caucus usually with one of two modifiers, either Iowa, the Iowa caucus, every presidential primary, or Democratic versus Republican caucus within a legislature. So it's clearly used a couple of different ways. Care to kind of break that down for us to start us off?
Yeah, the idea of caucus, obviously, is a group of individuals who share a party identification. And the way we hear it most often is the Democratic caucus or Republican caucus. And basically, that means all the Republicans who happen to be serving in the General Assembly, for example, that make up the Republican caucus. All of the Democrats who are serving in the U.S. House of Representatives make up the Democratic caucus there. So each of those bodies has caucuses, one for the Republicans and one for the Democrats. And that is what we hear most often. But when you think about the other version, the Iowa caucus, which of course is maybe the most famous version of this where we're nominating somebody, what that really is talking about is a nominating process. And caucus is not unique to Iowa. It's actually something that happens in a lot of states.
You've been to several caucuses. What are they like? What's the process like from start to finish, from everybody getting there to figuring out who their candidate or nominee is going to be?
For a lot of folks who live in this state, we're obviously used to primary election. We're used to 12 hours of voting. When we're nominating candidates, you show up sometime between 6 and 6, you cast your ballot, and you're done. But in a lot of other communities, even in the state of Indiana, as well as in other states, the way they handle it is through a caucus. And what happens then is there's actually a predetermined time when everybody shows up. So it's maybe 7 o'clock at night, or it's noon on a weekend, or whatever time is set. And everybody who's interested in participating shows up at the same time. What happens then is just a wonderful example of retail politics, where the candidates themselves quite often will be walking around the room saying, hi, how are you? My name is. I hope I can count on your vote. And even people who support those individuals will be walking around the room saying, hey, are you thinking about voting for so-and-so? I think she's great. You should vote for her. But it is just the most beautiful bit of retail politics you can see. And if people people want to observe this, they can wait, because in Indiana, from time to time, we have caucuses. For example, we had a couple recently to replace members of the county council on the Republican side. We also have communities like Monroeville, which will hold a caucus to nominate individuals to run for office. But beyond that, if they can wait a little bit longer, they can actually watch the Iowa caucuses, or at least a caucus from one place in Iowa, on C-SPAN usually. And it's great, because just watching people like you and me walking around a room saying to folks, I'm going to vote for so-and-so, and this is why I'm going to vote for them. So that's in the broadest sense how this works out. Obviously, each caucus is a little bit different then. But somewhere in the night, or in the meeting, I should say, the people who are running for office get to stand up and say, this is why you should vote for me. And if they're not there, then somebody else stands up and says, this is why you should vote for so-and-so. And then after that, you start counting votes, and the person with the most votes ends up winning. Iowa caucuses are a bit more complicated than that, and we can get into that in a little bit.
I do want to pick up on what you mentioned of whoever gets the most votes wins, because before we started recording today, you mentioned there's an example from the Monroeville caucus, right?
Yes.
From a few years back, where you may run into a scenario where there's a tie. Care to tell our listeners more about that situation?
Well, and actually, those, we don't have to go that far back. When the Republicans caucused in order to replace those members of council, nobody had a majority of votes. So they actually had to go through waves of votes in order to get to somebody having a majority. And this is something that happens in caucuses all the time. But many, many years ago, my dad and I were in Monroeville working a caucus. We were there to help administer a caucus. And this was pre-cell phone time. It was, you know, no one was carrying around pagers even. And after the first round of voting, and these were literal pieces of paper that were put into a box, a lot of people left after they cast their vote. They figured, hey, I'm done. This is like election day. I've done my part. I'm leaving. So they didn't stay around to find out who the winner was. And we counted the votes, pulled each piece of paper out, and we, at the end of it, said, we have a tie. And the rule said, then there's another ballot. But what had happened is people left. And so suddenly, folks were lining up at the payphone to call people at home and say, hey, you've got to get back here. People went to the restaurant next door. Hey, you got to come back in and vote. They went out onto the street, walking down the street, looking for anybody who was possibly a voter, dragging them back in to vote again. And so we actually did a second round of voting that had obviously a different number of voters. And even then, some people left after they voted. So even though it was the second time, knowing the first one ended in a tie, there were people who said, yeah, I've done my part. I'm ready to leave. Again. This time, though, when we were counting the votes, there were folks who basically camped out at the payphones just waiting to find out if there was a winner, because if there wasn't, they were going to call people and bring them back in. We actually went through three rounds of voting before we got to a winner. And the quote from Dad in one of the papers was, well, we could always flip a coin. So you take all of this knowledge of political science and all these rules and regulations, and in the end, sometimes what you end up doing is flipping a coin.
It is kind of amazing just to process, again, our electoral process coming down to simply the flip of a coin. And then in contrast, we have the first state in the national primary process with the Iowa caucus. And you have an example from 2008.
We have to remember that caucuses are very much retail politics, as we said earlier. It's about connecting with individuals and giving them a reason to want to support you. That reason, we always like to think, is because of highbrow policy issues. But what people need to remember is that Iowa takes place during the winter. The Iowa caucuses are in the winter. And I know an individual who was in Iowa in 2008, and this is obviously at a moment when people were assuming that Hillary Clinton was going to get the nomination. Sure, there was this person named Barack Obama who was doing fairly well, but was not necessarily anyone's top prospect for winning the whole thing. And the person I know went to the caucus where he was supposed to go. It was in a school. And when he walked in, he saw tables set up for everybody. Everybody who was a candidate had a table, and they were handing out yard signs and bumper stickers. And as he looked around the room, he saw that there was one table that had hot chocolate in addition to the yard signs and the bumper stickers. And he, like a lot of people, was fairly chilly. So he went to get himself a cup of hot chocolate. It happened to be the Barack Obama table. And as a lot of people know, Barack Obama ended up doing pretty well in Iowa. And I'm not saying that it's hot chocolate that is the key to winning a nominating process. But what that really did do was open up the opportunity for people to talk to one another. Because when folks came in who were cold, they went over to get a warm beverage. And the people who were handing out the beverages were able to say, this is why I support this candidate.
We also want to spend some of our time today talking about voting technology. And I think any of us who have gone to the polls these days are familiar with what our present-day voting machine looks like. But you've brought something to our studio that I haven't seen before. So care to give our listeners a bit of a description of what this machine is?
For a lot of folks, they'll know this machine. This is the practice version of an old lever voting machine. And for a lot of communities, these were the machines that were used from approximately the 1920s until the 1980s or 90s, depending on where they were, and even more recently than that. In Allen County, we started transitioning away from them in the 1990s. But these are machines that were used literally for about seven decades. And the practice version is great because it's a completely mechanical device, just as the machine was itself. And the way these worked, they were about 6 feet tall and 4 or 5 feet wide and weighed several hundred pounds. And when the voter walked up to the machine, what they did was close the curtain behind them by throwing a lever to the side. And then what they started to do was actually push down levers beneath the names of the candidates they were looking for. And when they were done, they simply opened the curtain back up again. And at that moment, every lever that was down, there was a counter, like an old odometer in the back of the machine that would have gone up by one if that lever was pushed down. Then at the end of the day, the people who were working in that precinct turned a crank that sent rollers across some carbon paper that read all of those odometer readings off of the back of the machine. And then down at the election board, there were people who got to pore over those pieces of papers for hours, totaling up all the votes cast.
Looking at this voting machine with all of its levers and labels, I have a couple thoughts. The first is that this wouldn't be a particularly good machine for someone who is visually impaired.
It goes beyond that, because these machines were actually quite tall, the old machines, the old lever machines. And if you were in a wheelchair, for example, you might not have been able to reach up high enough to pull all the levers down. Now, Indiana code has always had provisions to allow for someone to provide assistance. That might have been somebody who came to the polls with you, or it may have been precinct workers right there. You get one D and one R to go in with you so that nobody can cheat you, and you know they'll help you vote. Today, though, we actually have machines that will talk to you. And so if you are visually impaired, and this is something for everybody to know, if you're visually impaired, when you go to vote, you can actually say, I would like to vote for myself, I would like to vote by myself, and the box is known as a double talk box. So if you really want to sound like you know what you're talking about, say you want to use the double talk box, they plug it into the machine, and there are a set of headphones that you plug in, and you are then able to vote without any assistance. Keep in mind, it takes a lot longer because when you press buttons, it tells you what each button is. And whereas somebody who's not visually impaired can walk in and say, I know I want to vote for Ben Clemmer and just press that button and the X shows up and they move on, somebody who's visually impaired will walk in, press the button, and it will say, Ben Clemmer, not selected. They have to press it a second time, and then it will say, Ben Clemmer, selected.
Jim Banks, Republican Party, not selected. Courtney Trish, Democratic Party, not selected.
With how big these machines were, there had to be fewer voting precincts, right?
No, actually, there were, in some respects, more voting locations. Obviously, population has grown, so the number of locations is not a perfect comparison. But the requirements for where we had to have them, the number of precincts we had to have for voting was actually quite large. All of the machines were kept in a place we affectionately termed the barn. And if you walked in and were able to look from a little bit up, you would just see a sea of literally hundreds of these machines laid out. And every election, there were workers who had to go in and make sure that all of those counters were turned back to zero. They had to make sure that there was nothing wrong with any of the machines. And then a crew of people also came through, bipartisan crew of individuals came through to make sure that the right ballot was installed in each one and that none of the levers were working wrong, and that all of those counters were back to zero.
We're having this conversation about voting technology in an interesting time, I guess you could say, between, I think, there are a lot of conversations about voter fraud that you hear all over the place in the media, NPR as well. And then, of course, there is the specter of foreign interference in both elections, past and future. How does our technology today, and also how do volunteers today, like even at the local level, address the issue of election security and security concerns that people have even going into municipal elections in 2019?
There are a couple of ways to think about voter fraud, and one of them is the human element, and one is the technology. Even when you're talking about an old lever machine, there were ways to try and defraud the system, even with this very simple mechanical device. There are ways to attempt to defraud the system today that's very computer-based. So the technology allows for it no matter what. And in some respects, that's where the human element comes into play. While humans may be the vehicle to engage in that voter fraud, humans are also the vehicle for making sure that it doesn't happen. Indiana attempts to address this in what might seem to be a very simple way, and that is that virtually every step of the process requires that both Republicans and Democrats are involved. And so when the programming of the machines is done, when back in the day when we made sure that all those counters were back to zero, there were teams of Democrats and Republicans walking behind each of those machines to make sure all the counters were down to zero. When ballots are being counted, there are Democrats and Republicans who are counting the ballots. When there is a recount, there are Republicans and Democrats there doing the counting. And so we use the human element to help offset not only our own failings as human beings, but also the potential for the technology to be used in a nefarious way. Now, going back to what you said about volunteers, we should keep in mind that actually the folks who are working in the precinct on election day, they're getting paid a little tiny bit of money, so they're technically not volunteers. And I actually encourage people to contact their political party of choice, because the folks who are working in those precincts, the folks who are working in the voting locations and helping to count the votes, they're the ones who actually make sure the process runs as smoothly as possible, not only for the voter who's coming in, maybe for the first time, but also for the elected officials and the candidates who are waiting to hear what the vote totals are at the end of the day. So if there are folks out there who are interested in taking part in this process, very, very valuable contribution to our civic processes here, they should contact the party of their choice and let them know that they're interested in working on election day, and they'll be put into a database of folks who will be contacted to show up in May and November to make sure the process works smoothly.
I have two thoughts relating to election day before we end our time here. The first is potentially a single day for primaries, and another idea that's been getting kicked around quite recently is the idea of making election day a national holiday. What are your thoughts on those two possibilities?
People like the single primary day because our process just runs out over such a long period of time. People get tired of it, and they say, do it on one day and everything will work out better. That's a perfectly good argument, but we need to remember that if we go with that model, you have to be ready to campaign in every state on one day. And that is incredibly resource intensive, and not every candidate who ends up winning the nomination by our current system would have been able to compete in that old system. So if you think about Barack Obama, in the early stages, he was not viewed as one of the top two performers. He probably did not have the resources to run a nationwide primary single day primary. But since he met expectations, actually exceeded expectations in each of those early events, he managed to build credibility. He had managed to build momentum and therefore build up the resources that made it possible to compete in those later states.
And Election Day holiday?
As somebody who likes elections, one of my colleagues actually found an old sign in an antique store that said Election Day holiday day, or Election Day is a holiday, and so I hang it on my door every Election Day. But the reality is, if you make it a holiday, there are a lot of folks who would treat it like a holiday and not engage in their civic duty. So once again, pluses and minuses to it. There are plenty of employers who say, sure, you can have time to go vote, and there are other employers or types of employment that don't make that easy. Fortunately, we have things like early voting and mailed absentee ballots that make it a little bit easier. The single day is, or the election day holiday, still kind of attractive for a lot of reasons, though.
Andy Downs, thank you so much for being a part of this inaugural run of our WBOI Presents In Session series. And as always, thank you so much for all you contribute to the station.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to WBOI Presents In Session. You can find more episodes of WBOI Presents In Session at wboi.org. And while you're there, you can find the very latest from the WBOI news team. And stay up to date on content we produce year-round. Our theme music is by Noah Campodonico. Our sound effects are by John Dawkins. Our WBOI intern is Brandon Williams. Thank you for listening.